Malcolm Turnbull announced that the laws of math do not apply here.
One of my favourite brands of comedy aerial is brown people and black people making fun of white people.
Senators have been dropping like flies recently.
Shouting out the fact that in the Knowles Carter family, women just have one name.
Back chat on FBI Radio.
Hello and welcome to Back Chat on FBI Radio, the freshest wrap of news and politics on your airwaves. I'm Osman Faruqi.
I'm Ariel Bogle.
And today on the show, we're talking about the absolute shit show that is the High Court. So the High Court's going to be hearing two pretty big challenges that could upset the state of Australian politics at the moment. Next week, it's going to be talking about the postal survey on marriage equality. There's a decent chance it could get knocked off. We're going to be talking about that a bit later. But first, we're going to be delving into the citizenship fracas. So over the past few months, a whole litany of federal politicians have either referred themselves or been referred to the High Court over allegations that they're dual citizens. So we've had Scott Ludlam and Larissa Waters first up from the Greens, then Matt Canavan, Malcolm Roberts, Barnaby Joyce, Nick Xenophon, and now Fiona Nash, who next week is going to get referred probably by the Labor Party to the High Court. They're all dual citizens of different countries, New Zealand, the UK, Canada.
Some are really convoluted, like UK via India, via Cyprus. This is like a history, history lesson.
UK via Cyprus, right? It's like a history of colonization. So Nick Xenophon's dad was born in Cyprus when Cyprus was a British colony.
Yep.
And apparently that makes him a British citizen. So look, before we get into it, here's a bit of a recap of what's been going on.
It was brought to my attention that I hold dual citizenship.
I had no idea that I was a Canadian citizen.
Senator Ludlam's oversight is a pretty remarkable one when you think about it, that he's been in the Senate for so long.
I've never been to Italy and, to my knowledge, have never stepped foot in an Italian consulate or embassy.
The Deputy Prime Minister falling foul of the Constitution because he's too dopey to check his citizenship status.
Clearly the Labor Party are involved in a conspiracy using a foreign government, in this case New Zealand, to try and bring down the Australian government.
Is there a conspiracy against you, Deputy Prime Minister?
I don't know. I hope. I don't think so.
I was a British citizen by descent through my Scottish-born father.
Our legal advice is very, very strong.
And I wrote to them and said, I don't want to be accused of double dipping, so please, don't pay me any pension.
It seems that unusual one.
Well, that was actually Darren Hinch towards the end there. Darren Hinch is probably, he's a senator from Victoria. He's got one of the funniest cases that we've seen. Mm-hmm. He's trying to refer himself to the High Court, not because he's an American citizen, but because he's got a social security card.
Well, he worked in the US, I think, more than 10 years, paid tax there for more than 10 years, which makes him entitled to some US pension.
Some US benefit. Basically, the government has said, Darren Hinch, what are you doing, man? Like, you're not a citizen. You're not going to be ruled ineligible. But he's missing out, maybe.
He wants in on the action.
But there's all the politicians that we've mentioned so far, none of them are from the Labor Party. There's one Labor senator recently this week who the Daily Telegraph has alleged might be a dual citizen. Her name is Katie Gallagher. She's from the ACT, and the government has the Daily Telegraph has suggested, sometimes it's hard to tell.
Mm-hmm.
The government, again, I did it again. The Daily Telegraph has suggested that she could be an Ecuadorian citizen because her mother was born in Ecuador. And look, that wouldn't have been an issue, except in 2008, Ecuador changed its constitution. And as a result of that change, it could mean that Katie Gallagher is in fact an Ecuadorian citizen and therefore ineligible. She's denying it, but who knows? Again, it's just so much, there's a lack of clarity here.
Absolutely. And this week, one of Australia's sort of foremost constitutional law experts, the Dean of UNSW Law, George Williams, spoke at the press club, a sort of wide-ranging talk on all these constitutional issues. And he said in that he reckons about 20 politicians could potentially be caught up in this debacle by the end of it. And he also pointed out, which I thought was really interesting, that in the past, 10 members of the parliament have faced the High Court over Section 44, and only two have survived, which suggests the court, in the past at least, has, read this law rather strictly. And I just want to say, it's your own damn fault, guys. The constitution can only be changed by referendum, requires the parliament to suggest and put forward a referendum for the Australian people to vote on. You haven't done it. And it's been recommended over and over by various inquiries. And we can all say, the law is the law, of course, but Section 44 it's old. Like, it doesn't make sense in the kind of country we live in now where people have immigrated here. They have sort of entitlements and ties to other countries. Doesn't mean they can't be a good Australian politician. It's time to get rid of Section 44, but the government has you know, never looked at this picture and taken it on. They're always sort of after short-term political gains in the eyes of many. So, I don't know.
Yeah, look,
stung for it. I don't feel that bad for them.
No, and it's worth pointing out, we should have mentioned this earlier, in fact, that when we talk about Section 44, we've been talking this morning about the citizenship clause
exactly.
in particular, but there are a number of other bits of it that have been used to catch politicians out as well. So if you remember Family First Senator Bob Day from South Australia, he resigned from Parliament when it became clear that he was in breach of another section, another part of Section 44, which says that you basically can't profit from the Commonwealth. And
right.
there was suggestion that his electorate office or another electorate office was, in fact, he owned it and the government was leasing it off him.
Yeah.
There's a coalition, a Nationals MP from New South Wales called David Gillespie, who is currently facing a High Court challenge over similar allegations, which suggests that the Australia Post office in Lighthouse Beach in Port Macquarie, shout out to 2444, great my old post office, is being leased from a shopping centre that he owns. And the Labor Party candidate in that area is taking him to court. And why that's interesting is because he's in the lower house. And that means that if he's found ineligible and there's a by-election and the coalition loses that by-election, there could be the end of majority government.
Yep.
And that also applies to Barnaby Joyce, you know, if the High Court mm-hmm. finds that he's a citizen. So could this bring down the government? Let's find out what Malcolm Turnbull has to say.
The government is very confident that the court will not find the member for New England is disqualified from being a member of this House. Very confident indeed.
So the government's confident. As you mentioned, Ariel, Professor George Williams, one of the leading constitutional experts, is not so confident. And he's also had to say some stuff about the postal survey as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, so the postal survey is also up in the High Court next week, I think Tuesday and Wednesday. So the key question there is whether the government you know, has the legal ability to spend money on this quote-unquote postal survey in which Australians will be able to vote yes or no on the case, you know, whether to allow same-sex marriage here. And so the question is, you know, whether this kind of expenditure requires parliamentary approval, because, of course, it's spending your money, taxpayer cash. Mm. And the government does have powers to spend money that they haven't run through parliament. This is in cases where it's urgent or unforeseen circumstances. And, you know, I guess it's up to the court next week to interpret urgent, the word urgent, and unforeseen. Urgent seems like a sort of national security issue,
national disaster,
exactly.
Something like that. Yeah,
and unforeseen, no one can say that the case. Yeah.
I mean, some people might say that this government is a national disaster.
Dad jokes on your Saturday for everybody. And then the other question off to the side is whether the Australian Bureau of Statistics is also the right body
to
run this postal survey.
And it's worth, I guess, just reminding ourselves that the reason why we're having this kind of compromised postal survey is because the government did want a plebiscite run by the AEC, Australian Electoral Commission, but it failed twice to get that legislation through Parliament and has now come up with this, I guess, backdoor way to do it.
Sort of manoeuvring.
Yeah, so, you know, it'd be interesting to see whether the High Court says that's a valid attempt for them to have a crack at it doing that way, or is it just a blatant crack at trying to bypass Parliament? So that court case is going to be heard next week, this week coming up, and then in October we've got the case about the eight now politicians over dual citizenship issues, and it could be a pretty disastrous couple of weeks, not just for the government but for politics in Australia generally.
Well, for us, the people of Australia, want laws passed so we can do some things.
Yeah, and you think, what has the government done for the last few months? It just seems all we're talking about is the citizenship stuff and the Postal Survey High Court challenge.
Well, it is true that it seems like they're not doing anything, but this is kind of the circumstances that happen over in the US too. There's a lot of bluster, a lot of high-profile things get attention by the press, but behind the scenes, the government is pushing forward. For example, they're rolling out new sort of areas where they're doing this welfare card system where people on welfare are only allowed to spend cash on certain items, so taking away that freedom of how they spend their money. There's the PATH program sort of debacle that rolls on under the surface. So I feel like it is a legit disaster when politicians are dropping like flies and falling afoul of the Constitution, but it also is distracting, and there are things they are doing that we should be paying attention to and pushing back on, or at least debating, which we're not.
Sure. So to wrap up this chat, a lot of this goes back to the Constitution, obviously, and whether or not Section 44 is something the politicians should have seen coming.
Mm-hmm.
Is it time to change the Constitution?
Hell yeah.
Yeah? What do you reckon? What should be changed?
It's a great question. I do think that it's just not going to happen, a wholesale revision of our Constitution, unless we have a big sort of transitional moment in Australian history, and I think that would really be becoming a republic. when we become a republic, I think it's high time to take the chance to rewrite what is a severely archaic document. I encourage anyone to read that thing and see if it makes sense to you, because there are powers in there, you know, that allow the government to discriminate by race, things that we just don't think are okay now in contemporary society. So it's time to get that thing out. What would you change?
No, here, I agree. Look, I agree that we probably are unlikely to have a wholesale revisiting of it, but I think we should. Like, why not bring it on? It was written in the 19th century and we're in the 21st century. It was written by a bunch of old conservative white guys who were trying to figure out how to make the different colonies combine into one big colony.
Yeah.
Everyone was a British citizen back then. You mentioned the race powers. Mm-hmm. There's just stuff that's cooked and incongruous with where we're at now as Australia. And, you know, we could have a constitutional convention like we did when we messed up the Republic the first time and just bring some people together from different parts of Australia and say, hey, let's pretend that we're starting from scratch and see how we go.
Yeah, and there's been a push here for a long time to have some sort of Bill of Human Rights, but that would be a really great chance too to sort of make a statement of values about what Australia is and who we should become, who we should be in the centuries to come, basically. So back in 2015, you might remember a big campaign urging investors to get rid of shares in Transfield Services. This is, of course, the company that operated some of Australia's offshore detention centres, Nauru, Manus Island. So Bryn O'Brien was involved with that campaign at that time. She was part of the No Business in Abuse Collective, and she's now Executive Director of the Australasian Centre for Corporate Responsibility. She's working on shareholder activism, and this is something, you know, you might have seen in the press, in the financial press, but Bryn's going to help explain it to us. Welcome.
Hi, good to be with you guys.
So just to start off with, what is shareholder activism?
There's various definitions of shareholder activism, but I'll tell you about the style that I do. ACCR, Australasian Centre for Corporate Responsibility, holds a small portfolio of shares in large listed companies in Australia. And what we do is use those shareholdings to engage with companies on their environmental and social performance primarily. So it's about using a shareholding to express shareholder voice in what we call kind of a corporate democracy.
So when you say a small shareholding, how small are we talking? What's the minimum buy-in to have a say?
Yeah, the minimum voting share in Australia is 500 bucks.
Okay.
So we hold kind of around that or slightly more in maybe, you know, 10 or 12 big companies, and sometimes we'll purchase shareholdings for the explicit purpose of engaging with those companies on their kind of, you know, climate policy, for example.
Right. How did you get involved in shareholder activism?
I started my career as a corporate lawyer, I guess, a corporate litigator, and kind of learnt the power of corporate law and the language of corporate law at that point, then became a human rights lawyer, and over time just became really interested in how the financial world can be used and is willing to pay attention to certain issues where perhaps the companies creating the problem, so the companies that have bad climate or human rights practices, they might not be so interested in addressing it, but their investors might be. So over time, just kind of learnt that that was a potentially important area of work, and have only been in this role at ACCR since the start of the year.
Cool.
So I'm really curious about the sort of history of shareholder activism, because this is not something people are familiar with. Normally people think of shareholders as, you know, people that want to get wealthy based off the performance and the profits, the growth of a company. But how did shareholder activism get started as a sort of second or third path to being a shareholder?
Yeah, well, it's still a field in development in Australia. Mm-hmm. It's much more widely used in the United States and Europe, where shareholder resolutions and shareholder engagement on these issues is a much more rich field of practice. In Australia, it's quite difficult to lodge a shareholder resolution. So basically, you need 100 shareholders with a minimum voting share of 500 bucks each. So
right.
That's 50 grand at a minimum that you need to kind of have this voice at an AGM. So in Australia, we've seen kind of periods of shareholder activism. The union movement did a bit of it in the 90s and early 2000s. But recently, you know, we've seen a few shareholder resolutions put on climate issues by a few different organisations, my organisation and an organisation called Market Forces as well. But really, you know, we're still at the beginning of shareholder activism in Australia.
And how do you choose? So you mentioned that I think 12 companies that you guys have bought those stakes in. How do you target them? What are you basing that on? And is it an issues-based thing? Is it like, okay, we're going to focus on climate? Or do you start with the company and then look at the issues there?
At ACCR, we do the issues-based. We Each year we do a thematic report. So a couple of years ago we did one on climate risk disclosure. Last year we did one on political donations. And this year we're just about to publish one on human rights policies and disclosures by ASX 100 companies. So that's how we generally identify companies to which we might put resolutions. So companies that perform poorly on in our methodology, in our reports. But there's other times where civil society organisations, community groups or investors will approach us and say, actually, we've got a really big issue here. We've got a problem with this company and we're worried about them on this front. And then we'll start an engagement program there.
And how is this different to suing the company? So I think there's a case now against the Commonwealth Bank. Two shareholders there are suing the bank for failing to disclose some of the climate change risks. Is that like a different path? Is that related to your work, or which sort of version do you think is more useful in changing corporate behaviour?
Look, I think both are useful. It's obviously rarer that you're going to find a company to litigate against, and companies try to avoid litigation for obvious reasons. So, look, I think it's not as an aggressive an approach as litigation. They're quite different paths.
And do you think that one of the, like, $500 to me to buy into a company and get yourself a voice and, you know, sit at the table, doesn't sound like that much of a barrier. Is that something that you would encourage people to consider doing? And if so, is your organization a kind of place that facilitates that? So you said that you need 100 people that have the $500 investments. If I decided that, look, I want to become a shareholder activist, do I give you $500? How does that process work?
No, so you set up your own share portfolio, basically. You go go to one of the banks, will, you know, have these online shareholding portfolio sites. It's kind of very easy to do. And yeah, if you've got, you know, a couple of grand sitting around, like, not all of your listeners will have that, but if they do.
I'm not saying that I do.
Yeah.
Hypothetically, if I had, you know,
a bunch
of money. Yeah,
yeah. Well, if you've got a couple of grand laying around, and look, and if you're interested in buying shares for the purpose of, you know, engaging with companies on these issues, then ACCR can certainly be, you know, that hub for you. And we have an online database where there's, you know, a couple of hundred people who have already signed up. And
cool.
You go onto our website, it's resolution.accr.org.au, and you can nominate which companies you already hold shares in, and then you just click through and basically you nominate us, ACCR, to be able to lodge shareholder resolutions on your behalf. So that doesn't mean we can vote at meetings or anything like that. It just means that you can be one of the 100 shareholders that stands with us to put an issue on the agenda for an AGM.
And what's the reaction been so far from corporate Australia? As you said, it's sort of activist shareholding is a new phenomenon here. Has there been a lot of pushback, or is there a recognition from the companies that maybe, you know, being better on climate, better on workers' relations is better in the long run?
So what ACCR does is quite unique, because we're a civil society organisation that does activist shareholding. But in terms of, like, the big investor world, investors are engaging with companies on these kinds of issues quite regularly. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the, like, there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that goes on in the Australian financial space on lots of different issues.
No worries. So, of course, you were once part of the divestment campaign against Transfield Services. How do you see that technique playing out? Is that still a good strategy for people to pursue? Because, of course, you don't need that financial buy-in to lobby for divestments.
Yeah, so divestment campaigning is kind of one piece of the responsible investment puzzle. There's three pieces. So there's kind of divestment and exclusion, there's engagement with companies, and that's what shareholder resolutions are, and then there's impact investing as well. So all of those three pieces are really kind of part of the scene and really useful. I think divestment is most useful in extreme kind of cases where improvements can't be made. So, for example, you know, improvements can't be made to the offshore detention system.
Right.
So it's just about pulling the plug.
It's just about pulling the plug, that no company should be involved in that stuff because it's catastrophic.
Cool. And look, just before we move on to our next segment, Bryn, are there any resolutions, you know, that you guys are currently talking about or are on the agenda that we should keep our eyes open for?
Yeah, we've got three going at the moment. Two are based on our human rights report that I mentioned earlier. So they're to the big supermarket companies, so Wesfarmers, which owns Coles, and then Woolworths. And we're putting resolutions to them to basically ask them to do and disclose more about how they try to protect people's human rights in their supply chain.
Yeah,
so we've
right.
seen exploitation on farms in Australia as well as overseas in food supply chains. So we're really trying to put that issue on the board's agenda. The other one that we're doing at the moment is to BHP, basically drawing attention to their hypocrisy on climate change. They position themselves in relative terms as leaders on climate and sustainability, but yet they're the largest financial member of the Minerals Council of Australia and, you know, a lobbying group which actively obstructs sensible climate and energy policy in Australia. And we say that actually that runs totally contrary to BHP's interests and shareholders' interests and the planet's interests.
Well, super interesting. We'll be very keen to see how that works out. Bryn O'Brien, thank you so much for joining us on Backchat this morning.
Thanks very much,
and
guys.
You're sticking around for my favourite segment, the only reason I get out of bed on Saturdays. Here it is. That's right, it's Backchat Roulette, where we all share stories from the week that we thought were important and not enough people paid attention to. Ariel, would you want to kick it off for us?
For sure. So this is an ongoing story. It's live right now in San Francisco. The Russian consulate there is being closed, so the Trump administration is shutting it. It's sort of part of this ongoing Cold War, dare I say, between Russia and the US, retaliations expelling various, you know, diplomatic corps on both sides, but in both countries. So what's happening in San Francisco today is everyone noticed like this big plume of black acrid smoke coming out of the Russian consulate chimney, wondering what the hell is going on there. And the fire brigade went there, the Russian consulate staff were like, no, don't worry, it's chill. Obviously burning like all the stuff in there. And there's like some Twitter videos, heaps of people hanging out at the consulate to check out what's happening. There's like a small bonfire in the backyard of the consulate. There's a great video of that. What are they burning? I guess we'll never know.
I'm surprised that they still have like documents to burn. Like what?
Maybe it's so acrid because they're burning
CDs.
Yeah,
they're burning CDs and hard drives. Yeah, fascinating. Bryn, what have you got for us?
Look, I'm going to depress everyone on a Saturday morning, but Manus Island, we've just, it is really a human rights catastrophe. The centre is apparently closing for a number of reasons. One is because it's been found by the PNG Supreme Court to be illegal. Another is because the government can't find any corporations to take the work over. Basically, the Australian government is just abandoning 800 men into the community in Papua New Guinea where they don't have any protections, they don't have any hope, any possibility. It's just extraordinary to me that it's come this far, and it's terribly sad. So that's it for me.
No, thank you for the reminder. It's an issue that we've covered a few times and probably something that we'll get back to as well on Backchat. My story is about alcohol consumption. it's on the rise, believe it or not, for the first time in a decade. So do you remember back in 2007? I mean, this shows my age. I think 2007, 2008, Kevin Rudd introduced the Alcopops tax.
Oh, yes.
Right? There was this huge kind of like fear-mongering campaign that
discriminating against girls. Discriminating against Smirnoff Black.
Yeah, exactly.
No more Bacardi breezes.
There was this huge moral panic about kids binge drinking and going wild. But the interesting thing was the numbers were showing that alcohol consumption for Australians across the board, but particularly young Australians, was on the decrease.
Mm-hmm.
This year, for the first time in more than 10 years, it's ticked up a little bit. So Australians on average are drinking 10.7 litres of pure alcohol a year. That's up from 10.5 litres last year. But both of those numbers are way down from the heyday of the 60s and 70s when Australians were drinking 13 litres.
Whoa.
So it's kind of an interesting statistic. I don't know the reasons for why it's been going up and down and why it's picked up in the last year or so. But the overall story is this big decline in terms of Australians' alcohol consumption, which does seem kind of jarring with the kind of rhetoric that we see. So this idea of lockout laws and the fact that young people are just going crazy and taking alcohol and doing drugs, the numbers don't really bear that out.
Yeah, we're a very chill generation.
A very chill generation. Look, it's all we got time for on Backchat this morning. I'm saying farewell for 3 weeks. I'm going on a bit of a holiday, but no doubt Ariel and whoever you find to fill in for me will be... We'll be even
more
better.
More than able.
More than able. And it's going to be the best 3 weeks of Backchat ever. Bryn, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
A special shout out to Sam, John Shah, EP, Oscar Coleman, who's been our digital producer for a long time. I don't know exactly how long, 18 months at least. He's leaving next week and I'm not going to be here to say goodbye. So massive, massive thanks, Oscar, for all the work that you've done while I've been on the show. Looking forward to catching up with you in Adelaide. And of course, Linda Hong, thank you so much for all of your help.